howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bumalam Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
With me in the bunker today is actor Arthur Bostrom, who's best known for playing Inspector Crabtree in BBC TV's French resistance sitcom Allo Allo between 1985 and 1993. I shall try to resist saying good morning in a cod French accent. But Arthur's with us today because not only is he a huge Doctor Who fan, but we recently got him in to play the Doctor himself in our audio adaptation of the pilot episode of the animated version of Doctor Who from Nelvana Studios that came close to happening in the 1990s. The audio drama will be available on disc, free with Warp 5, available very soon, or now, depending when you're listening. More on that later, but for now, Arthur Bostrom, welcome to the bunker.
Thank you.
Great to meet you. Obviously, I know you vaguely from Manchester days, and we've got lots of people in common, I think, who are from Brain Edge and... my good friend Andy Sykes,
yeah.
Who was in... Well, I think you've been in a few things with him, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
But he's in LA now,
yes,
acting, yeah. And I'm actually about to see him.
When we get me and Gareth go out
for the Doctor Who convention
that's,
out there.
That's going way back, somewhere like 2008 or something.
Yeah, it's when I was quite new to Manchester, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's... but yeah, that was a really good one, a Trevor Suffers. Anyway, we're off, massively off topic.
Yeah, we are.
Talk about dropping names that lots of people won't know about. Because obviously we have people that, you know, listen to this. Doctor Who is a worldwide phenomenon. So people will be listening to this that don't know a lot about British culture outside Doctor Who, let alone anything else. Which we'll come on to later when we talk about Allo Allo and things like that. Mm. But this is an interview, you know, it's got Doctor Who at its centre, and you've made your 5 choices, and your 5 choices are all from the 60s. So I guess, as you were saying off mic, Doctor Who is a big part of your life, and you're, people can see when you were born on Wikipedia, but you were there and remember the first ever episode.
I do, and I was 8 years old. November 23rd, 1963, I think, was the first episode. And I can just remember, I can remember everything about that episode, that first episode, An Unearthly Child. You know, we'd heard about the series coming up. We knew it was happening. But we didn't know what it would be about. And really the game changer for me, the moment, which I'll never forget, because it begins with the teachers, Barbara and Ian, at a local, I think, comprehensive or secondary school, and they've got this extraordinary pupil, Susan, who keeps sort of letting slip extraordinary scientific facts and everything that they, and it whets their curiosity. So they decide to follow her home, and they end up in this really sort of gloomy junkyard, and in the middle of it is this police box, which was a thing that you don't see them now, you only see them on Doctor Who, but then you did used to see police boxes, particularly in London, all the time. So it was very strange, and then you hear this voice coming from inside the box, and they decide to go inside to follow, and they walk in to what is the interior of the TARDIS. So it was that moment of them blundering through the doors into this huge space. Now, I mean, you know, it's 60 years ago nearly. And so that kind of thing, when you consider CGI and all of those things that can be done now. But to an eight-year-old, that just blew me away. And it didn't just blow me away. It's like when we got to school, I was primary school on Monday, you know, everyone had watched it.
Mm.
And everybody's saying, you know, it was bigger inside than outside. How did that, you know, and just that single thing just, A, it completely hooked us to it. You know, I mean, I'd never seen anything like it before. And whoever thought that up, and, you know, this was before the revelation about the TARDIS, meaning time and relative dimension in space, you know, and all of that, which was one of those little factoids that came out, you know, later in the series.
Yeah, it's brilliant to hear, actually. I mean, that is just being sort of ground zero of this cultural phenomenon.
Well,
But a lot of the sort of the received wisdom is often Doctor Who was all right for 4 weeks and then the Daleks happened. But you're sort of reminding people the concept itself. Even without the Daleks, it did something.
Yeah, the thing that followed where they went to, which was Stone Age and all of it, it wasn't very interesting.
No.
But we were already hooked from that and couldn't wait to go back to the TARDIS again and get inside that because that was interesting. I've always been, you know, pretty well... Everything that I really saw anything when they were in the TARDIS. I just found that fascinating. I never really got over that big, you know, that big surprise in that first.
It's an amazing idea. It's a simple idea, but just amazing. I mean, it's part Narnia, part, you know, part of the wardrobe going to another world.
Yeah.
With a scientific thing behind it. But I remember seeing, you know, a TARDIS prop at BBC TV Centre when I was a kid. My dad used to work there. And I ran into it and got, I mean, I've said this in another podcast, but I got covered in spiders and the cloth had come down.
Oh.
And I just got covered in dust and spiders. And I literally, I mean, I was probably 10 and I was half expecting it to be bigger on the inside.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Because of the, but it's weird about, I mean, what was it like? Like how, the one thing we can never recapture is they took something every day like a police box, which now isn't every day. So it doesn't. Even at that remove, it became Doctor Who's TARDIS. I mean, there was a clip not so long ago that was doing the rounds on Twitter, which was Harry Styles, the film where he plays a gay policeman in the 60s. And he's coming out of a police box, and loads of people thought he was in Doctor Who. Because they had no idea why he'd be coming out of a TARDIS.
Yes,
So what was it like picking that as an object?
I think absolutely brilliant, because if it had been a regular telephone box, which is see-through anyway, I mean, that would it was...
Like the Rod Hull version.
Yeah, but it was supposed to be... I mean, it's explained, and I can't remember when. I mean, the notion that actually, you know, the Doctor didn't really know where they were going to materialise...
Mm.
You know, because there were faults with the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to disguise itself.
Yeah.
I think there is a comment, I think. There is a sort of... I think in that first...
Yeah, when it first...
Four, we'd say, that's strange, it hasn't changed into something. You know, so that little fact has stayed for 60 years.
Yeah, right from the beginning it's become... The chameleon circuit is broken.
Is that what it is? I can't remember.
But because it's in a junkyard, lots of people said, why is there a police box in a junkyard?
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, if it had been outside in the street, it would have made more sense.
I think because it was supposed to be on Barnes Common when they were first writing up the idea. And obviously, I think for whatever reasons, in rewrites and everything having to be on set, they went, well, junkyard, we can do a junkyard.
Yeah.
And it's still... And it's, in a weird way, it's just magic. Anyway, a police box in a junkyard becomes like a classic line. It's like, police box
even
in a junkyard?
Well, exactly,
it's weird. It's incongruous in a junkyard.
Even before they stumbled through the doors and that revelation came, that in itself of seeing this thing in there where it wouldn't be, you know, was amazing. So that used to... It's that sort of thing I've always been, you know, subsequently, and this is probably... because of this influence from Doctor Who from way back then. But I've always been interested with anything that's mysterious and largely unexplained. And now we're in an age where everyone's got an explanation for everything, you know, whether it's right or not. You know, mm-hmm. But I actually like the not knowingness, the mystery of it. And many aspects of Doctor Who, you know, as the years went on, still remained mysterious. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, it's still in the 60s, the end of the tenure by Patrick Troughton, the second Doctor. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that that's where we first find out about Time Lords.
Yeah.
Well, and what that was fascinating, but in a way, it kind of also spoiled something because I had a big explanation about who Doctor Who, you know, well, who is he and where is he from? And now we have a. He actually is from a planet where there's more of these people. We sort of knew about that because there was this other character that used to come called the Meddling Monk. And that was another thing to also, his TARDIS did still have the facility to disguise itself.
Yeah.
You know, but I liked all that, but we still didn't know who they were. And I quite like those things not ever being really revealed, you know.
Yeah.
Keeping it from...
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing now with all the lore and the mythos that's accrued around it and all the endless pub arguments at conventions. Yeah. But, I mean, John Pertwee himself said, oh, I wish we'd never named Gallifrey and lots of things like that. You know, you keep him mysterious. And it's, you know, now they... I mean, the Doctor hasn't quite got a family tree, but they've got so many different things that they do know about. The Time Lords and Gallifrey, and as Russell T. Davis calls them, the men in silly hats. he killed well, he killed the buggers before it came back, and then they still come back.
Yes,
all the weird time.
But I think, you know, to go back to, you know, its beginnings. Now I think somebody coming to Doctor Who's going to enjoy it because it's still a great series and great adventures and. Or usually has something that challenges you. The fact that it's still changing now, changing sex as well. Mm. You know, it was about time. I mean, more than about time, really. It's been talked about. That had been talked about for some time, but they finally did it. I thought, yeah, good.
Yeah.
You know. But then back in, you know, as something in 1963, it was completely unprecedented.
Mm.
And the effect it had. It's true for those that say, well, nothing much happened and then the Daleks arrived. But the Daleks, just for me, well, I mean, that absolutely went into another stratosphere. We'd never seen anything like it before.
Yeah.
And they were terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And it's a cliche where people say, you know, we used to hide behind the sofa. But I did.
Yes.
I was, and everybody
so
else did. It was just, I wanted to see it, but I was terrified. When they came on, you know, when the Daleks came on, you know, your heart was pumping. And
we're in Liverpool today in your lovely, lovely apartment. The last time I was in Liverpool was before Christmas when I went to the exhibition, the Doctor Who exhibition at Worlds of Wonder.
Mm.
With my son, who's seven, and I don't force things on him, but he's absolutely obsessed with Doctor Who for some reason. And the Dalek, he was scared of it, and then he got inside one and was one, and was scaring other kids. But the thrill, I never tire of the fact that since 1963, kids in this country have been shouting exterminate.
Yeah.
In the playground.
Yeah.
And it works. Just on a very basic level, it's you know, it's one of the best things about being British, if you ask me. You know, we've got this mad show,
and
the Daleks, and it all just seemed to be dreamed up by.
I mean, if you'd asked, you know, even when I was at university watching it, it's kind of when I tailed off really with it, but it was still very important to me. And but if you'd have asked, if I'd have been asked, then, you know, how long do you think this will carry on? Well, I think when it did stop after Colin Baker's thing, I thought, well, that was that. I think it's remarkable that it came back.
Mm-hmm.
and what they did with it, you know, it really took it into the 21st century. And
that's wonderful, Denisha.
Yeah, and you know, and it's, and the look of it, you know, because you go back, I when I was eight, I didn't notice that, bless him, William Hartnell wasn't terribly good at his lines,
no.
You know, often. He was quite old, you know. But what I, you we're don't notice...
We're watching a lot of first takes, though. I mean,
yeah.
It's almost as live sometimes.
Well, I think some of it is as live.
Yeah.
I think it was done like that. A lot of filming in that time was done, carried through. I think they probably did the whole episode, you know. Like
no retakes and you're going to, you know, and we're going to still be watching it in 60 years.
I know.
It's terrifying.
But he had a, you know, the other thing about which I don't think people particularly credit of all the Doctors, he was really mysterious and, mm-hmm. and quite... He could be quite childish,
mm-hmm.
and tantrums, and I mean the famous thing about why they, you know, the plot thing about why they have to go and down into the Dalek city in the first one is because he has, you know, booby trapped his own TARDIS, and there was nothing wrong with the fluid links at all, you know, whatever a fluid link is, but you know, it's willful.
Yeah, no, his personality got sort of. Retconned to make him the hero quite a way into Patrick Troughton's sort of era.
Yes.
They kind of, because they were still working out who the Doctor was, and he was sort of based a bit on Quatermass mixed with the Doctor Smith, is it, from Lost in Space.
Oh, yeah.
So the heroes were supposed to be the people who'd been kidnapped and forced, you know, half forced to go on these adventures.
Oh,
but then it sort of come round to be about the Doctor, and he is this massive force for good. So, yeah, we lost a lot of the mischievous stuff that Hartnell kind of was told this is part of who the Doctor is.
Yeah, I really liked that.
Yeah.
I think Troughton had that as well.
Yeah.
He was a different sort of...
He wouldn't have put his companions in danger like
that. No. He was much more pragmatic.
Let's go out into a radioactive city.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm curious.
Yes, well, I mean, a one word, it's not really a word, but William Hartnell was used to often end a line with, so what do you think we should do?
Yeah.
You know, he would always do this,
Yeah.
And that absolutely was him.
Hi, Ian here. As we said in the intro, Arthur's playing the Doctor in our audio adaptation of the pilot script for the version of Doctor Who from Canadian animation studio Nelvana that got very close to getting made. You can find the full story of this tantalising what-if in the latest edition of renowned Doctor Who fanzine Warp Warp, the magazine that ultimately spawned Cutaway Comics. As well as the Nelvana audio drama, free with the magazine as a cover-mounted CD, the new Warp Warp also includes an exclusive 22-page comic strip from Lance Parkin and artist Steve Andrew, featuring the 12th Doctor up against the Roman robots of the Iron Legion. We've got interviews with John Ridgway and Steve Parkhouse too, both talking about their classic 6th Doctor comic strip Voyager. And there's an in-depth look at Absalom Dak, as well as a brand new comic strip featuring the fabled Dalek Killer, and much, 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 much more. To order online from anywhere in the world, visit warpwarp.co.uk, or for any of our overseas listeners who'll be going to Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles in February, Gareth and I will be there with piles of Warp Warps to sell, along with the first of Cutaway Comics' Gods and Monsters saga, and a few of our highly collectible back catalogue that haven't yet sold. See you in the dealer's room and the bar. To sort of get onto your first choice anyway, because it wasn't an unearthly child, but that's the first episode. But your first actual choice is, and you've got it with you, heartbreakingly, we'll take a picture of it as well, heartbreakingly, half of a genuine, bought at the time, 1964 Doctor Who annual.
Yes.
I mean, was that Christmas...
63? Christmas, yeah, Christmas. Not 63, because it only just...
Oh, God, you've
crossed,
I
think it was 64.
Yeah.
So... I think, and
also
I mean,
just over a year of Doctor Who's existence.
Yeah, I was a crazed addict.
Dalek mania.
Yeah,
and Beatlemania was sort of what a year.
All of those. Yeah, yeah. And that was another thing because I saw the first televised appearance of the Beatles. You know,
oh,
I think
wow.
it was 64.
Yeah,
and you know, cutting, you know.
Here we are in Liverpool.
Well, quite. A stone's throw from the Beatles Museum. But all of those sort of firsts, really. Yeah, the annual, I just read and read and read it. But it was rather, in a way, rather too advanced for me. The writing was, it wasn't quite, although the illustrations showed William Hartnell and the others and all that, the places they visited and the things were sort of bleaker in a way than what we were seeing, you know. And there was this big Zarby story. Yeah. So that was characters that I had already met, but there were lots of other ones. I think there's one that's in an under, you know, it's a long before Waterworld, the disastrous movie, but it was just a water-covered world, and I seem to remember there was something about it. And it's really quite, it was very intense, actually, the writing. Good writers wrote for that sort of thing. But, you know, it's the fact that it was, and, you know, once the merchandise started to come from Doctor Who, which was an acknowledgement of just how successful it was becoming, then, you know, one wanted to have all that. You know, I was dressing up as the Doctor and pretending to be a Dalek or pretending to be the Doctor myself in 1964, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, your second choice is the Rolikins. Yes, Daleks.
Dalek Rolikins.
67,
I think. 67, I think, yeah. And so I was 12 then, and I remember, because I'd already got a battery-operated Dalek by then, which looked pretty good. It looked like a proper Dalek, although the head was a bit wrong. And also, one of the things they decided, well, we've got a battery, so we'll do this, is the interior bit of the head of the Dalek came on, flashed on and off like blue light, like a police car, which was odd because Daleks didn't have that.
No.
You know, so it was sort of, I don't think you've, have you been watching the series? Probably, you know. But by then, you know, it wasn't colour by then, so maybe they didn't know. Maybe they thought that's what was going on.
I bet they had a load of leftover, they were going to make police cars and they had a load of blue lights left over.
That's a thought. I think you could well be right. But what that one did, I will get back to my choice, but the Rolikins. But what that did was, it had a kind of rotating wheels at the bottom, so it would go round and round. So it would move forward, but if it reached an object, it would reverse itself, which was something that the Daleks did.
Yeah.
You know, you're moving back from the control button and then moving off.
Had that level of sensitivity, you know.
Yeah,
in it.
That's, yeah, back at that time.
Yeah.
But the Rolikins, which were tiny, I mean, they're a tiny little model. I would think not much more than an inch high. And at the base, there was a metal ball, so it would move around on this single metal ball. Mm. So they were kind of little tiny, tiny things, and they only cost, I don't know, 10 bob or less than that.
75 quid on eBay now.
Yes, so I gather. Of course, these things. Yeah. And I think if I'd kept my Dalek, my battery, it's on for 390.
Yeah, oh,
so
wow.
I'd be cashing in. But anyway, yeah. And this novel, the annual as well, is worth a bob or two as well.
Yeah.
But Rolikin, I was at grammar school by then, and my best friend and I had found these things from a toy shop in our hometown of Rugby. And so we'd started collecting them. Mm. And there was a craze. We had very old-fashioned desks, you know, almost Dickensian, even with old inkwells in it that were not used anymore. Mm. But that's how old I am, and that's how old my school was. But and we had a craze of putting all our books inside the desk. It was a really, you know, you had all your books in there. And then arranging in between different levels little bits of wood so that things could slide down and make a noise and stuff like that. So we used to put these Dalek Rolikins on this. And so halfway through a Latin lesson, you'd hear this sound from someone's desk and then a crash at the other end. And what was that? You know, well, I mean, it was never discovered. But my friend Graham, he would be more likely to be the one to do that.
Mm.
And so from the other side of the classroom, I would hear this sign, and I thought, I know what that is. That's a Dalek red
crashing.
Dalek Rolikin crashing down a ramp. So I mean, you know, that's a very obscure, but it's why it sticks in my mind.
It must have been everywhere. I mean, Apparently they sold, by October 65, they'd sold a million in the UK.
Oh, wow. I don't, you see, with stats like just, that, you see, weren't available then.
No, no,
they
no.
They just happened
but
to
just,
be.
But just like, that's...
We couldn't, we wanted to get more because we liked having a little group of them. Yeah. We kept going to the same toy shop and they... This woman that owned it said, no, we don't have any. You know, they were out of stock there for a long time. And that was that, you know.
Yeah.
But where how they disappeared and how I didn't get. But I looked it all up, and of course, you know, it's there in the annals of Doctor Who history.
Oh, yeah. There's essays on the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, Doctor Who's one of those things. There's lots of people into lots of different aspects of it. And some people are experts on the toys and collect the toys and you know, there's always every convention is always an interesting sort of. It's an interesting insight into sort of British industry in that era.
Well, you see, I mean, and, I thought as a choice for something to take into the bunker, I thought, well, it's something I could play with.
Yeah,
and the annual was something I can read. Yeah,
exactly. See, so you go slightly insane. As you...
Well, I definitely go insane.
yeah.
But,
so you're eating your cat food and playing with your other kids.
Yeah.
But No, but wonderful choice. Wonderful choice. One of your choices, when we talk about Celestial Toymaker, one of your choices, Alan Moore, the very famous writer, that's, you know, he's got a similar relationship to Doctor Who as you has, and he watched it when he was a kid and appreciates it and wrote some of it when he was first starting off. But Celestial Toymaker is the one that's held up as him as his all-time favourite episode that he couldn't get out of his head. And quite a lot of people who watched it at the time think there must be something magical about the Celestial Toymaker.
Well, there is. And again, you know, it's what I was going on about early Doctor Who, the really good ones that stand out, the episodes, the stories that stand out, where there is this mystery. Because it was never really explained where this place was. So you had this, you know... You had this space where there were these really rather grotesque characters, quite Alice in Wonderlandish, you know, very, very odd, where this toy maker had this sort of endless games. Whoever kind of happened on this place had to play these games, and if you lost, you died, you know. I mean, it was evil. And very scary, because I found it quite nightmarish. And that's the thing about nightmares or mysterious or any of these things. You're scared of it, but you want to watch. Mm. So, like, in a different way to, you know, what I was saying about the Daleks. So I do remember this thing. Michael Gough, who played the Toymaker, who's a brilliant actor, is sadly no longer with us. But I always, you know, throughout my life, I've always admired his performances. And he was brilliant. And also, looking back, I mean, you know, my years will come to it, but about being at a lower low, but Carmen Silvera, who played Rene's wife, Edith, was one of the two clowns in that.
Yeah.
Because she told me she was in Doctor Who, and I always wanted, you know, well, tell me about your time in Doctor Who, you know, because it always just threw me back, you know, to the 60s, and it was in the 60s that she was in it.
Yeah.
And she told me about it. I said, you were in that? I said, that's my favourite ever. I think, and I really do think it was. And I know that, you know, apparently you can't, you know, the tapes are lost, or most of the tapes are lost.
Yeah.
But for me to remember how it looked, how it played on my fears, if you like, or my imagination at the age of, probably I was 9 by then, or 9 or 10. And all these years later, nearly 60 years later, how I still remember the impact it had on me. That says something about how good it... But it was this mysterious place. I mean, there were various things where I can remember there was a couple of episodes, both set in the TARDIS quite early on. I think it was after they left the Daleks, but Edge of Destruction or something like that. But there they were in a kind of, you know, between... universes or whatever, or a no man's land or something, which was mysterious, you know. They couldn't land anywhere, because where were they? They were in a nothingness or something. But the idea that you could be transported, or you could land, or the TARDIS could materialize in this otherworldly place, just opened up my imagination, if you like. And I don't know whether Doctor Who is given full credit for that, really, to those of, you know, of that time, when now we're so much more used to sophisticated scenarios. Well, then we weren't.
it's a real shame that it's one of the episodes we can't see, because I think it has genuinely been influential to those who saw it. Like, a lot of kids had their minds blown in the 60s
Interestingly, on the Wikipedia page, which I found when I was sort of, you know, having remembered it, I thought, oh, is my memory of who was in it and what was all about accurate? You know, I can remember the effect it had, like, and I've got a visual memory, and I can remember Michael Gough's voice. It was like, move to something or other, something like that. You know, I mean, it's the voice.
Yeah.
You know, which I think one of the characters at the end imitated that voice, which got them out of there and got them back into the cards. That was the sort of end game to it, which was clever, you know, but it was, but I can remember this creepiness of it. But on the Wikipedia page, there was references to, you know, they did sort of polls about what people had thought about it, and a lot of people didn't like it. And I guess that's, well, it was very unlike previous ones. You know, it wasn't, there wasn't a sort of an obvious robotic killer, you know, adversary, or the sort of standard Doctor Who plot type of that. It was very revolutionary,
and
so, like a lot of things that, you know, at the time people go, oh, I'm not sure about that, they later become classics because enough people go, oh, I guess I can understand that a lot of people didn't go for it there, but I loved it.
So you were born in Rugby, and Doctor Who blew your mind. When did you first realise acting was calling you?
Oh.
And how much was it to do with Doctor Who?
It wasn't really anything. Well, it probably was to do with that. Yes, that probably did. Because when something gets you extremely focused in the way that did, not just this is on television, this is this particular program and how the person was acting it. I don't, it's certainly not consciously, I would, I wanted to, I used to play Doctor. There was a much younger girl that lived two doors away, the younger sister of a great friend of mine, and but she used to come around and want to play. And by then, I was using the garden shed in our back garden as my pretend TARDIS. And my dad, bless him, had put together a sort of makeshift made out of, well, just got some old switches and put them on a sort of, you know, control panel. Connected to nothing. I just used to pretend, you know. But actually, the old TARDIS panel was quite old-fashioned. I mean, it had sort of rheostats and ammeters and amperes, you know, so on it. But I just thought it looked cool, you know. And so, but you know, young kids, you know, they can just believe they're doing it, can't they? So, but she was always Susan. She was grandfather, and she asked a few times. She said, "When can I play the Doctor?" And I said, "Well, you can't. You know, why not? Well, because you're a girl." But, you know, so I've been proved wrong with that now. And it took them nearly 60 years to do that one. But that's really where it came. But I did get to play. I was, well, not because I volunteered. In those days, if you were told to do something, you did it. But at primary school, my last year, we had a Christmas show, a play, and I had one of the leads in it. You know, I've always had an ability to just pick up something and read it cold with expression. And I assumed everybody else could do that, but they can't, actually, it turns out. So I've always been able to do it, and I could do it then. So I was always the person being asked to read the lesson in assembly or something like that, you know, because I could just do it. It doesn't make you an actor, but it makes you something creative or a bit more dependable than you can do that. So I did that. And I was apparently quite good in this thing, but I still didn't have any pretensions of doing this. Then I got, again, told I was in the school play, which was Macbeth, in the sixth form, and I was terrible in it, but I found it so enjoyable, the whole thing, that I auditioned the next year and then was in a Tom Stoppard play, which was very revolutionary for the late 60s or early 70s by then. And found I had a gift for comedy and timing. Well, it's sort of, looking back, it was obvious because I was always the one that was imitating teachers, and I could sort of be witty about stuff. But you don't think about that when you're in your you don't now. You may do now with social media and what's possible. But then you didn't think of that as being any kind of marketable quantity, you know, good quality later on. You just think, this is who I am. You know, it was my way of standing out. I wasn't a terrific sportsman. I wasn't, you know, but I could make people laugh, you know.
Mm.
And then that grew from that. But even so, when I was at university, I still, it took me a while to dare to audition for something.
Yeah, so you didn't go to drama school?
No, I went to Durham University to read geography.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a year before I dared to audition for something. And I got straight in and I went to the Edinburgh Festival with the university. I was with the University Review Company, which is equivalent of Cambridge Footlights and all of that. Because I had been writing sketches and stuff at school. And I found that actually the level I was at was as high, if not higher, than what they were already doing there. You just don't know until you test it out.
Yeah.
And then I sort of became a leading comedy light at university.
Mm.
But it wasn't until my final year of deciding what I was going to do with my life going forward that I thought, well, and enough people had said to me, you could do this for real.
Mm.
And I think if I'd not gone away out of, you know, Rugby, where I'm from, was a nice town. I had a happy, pretty safe upbringing, blah, blah, blah. But there was nobody famous living there, or I'd never met an actor, professional actor.
Mm.
I'd never, you know, I didn't have, no one in the family had, there was no family connection with anybody who'd done it. So I didn't really have enough to do that. It was only when peers at university complimented me on things that it gave me, and said, you could do this for a job, that it seemed a possible reality. So I did do a one-year course at a school called the Drama Studio that was pretty new then, that specialised in a one-year course for older people.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of 20-plus, but, you know, there were mature students there. A lot of Americans as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt I needed that year to give me what I would call a professional head.
Yeah.
In other words, not only get myself really fit, learn a bit. I already could act, you know, enough people had said, you know, and I felt I was confident, but I got to just focus on that for a year.
Mm.
And it was a really good thing I did that, because I kind of then you had to be a member of the actors union Equity. It was a closed shop if you weren't in that, but you couldn't be in that until you had got a job. So it was there was this sort of
Catch 22.
Yeah, and there were only limited offers of things. So everybody was in competition for one. And I was lucky I got one straight away, within about 8 weeks of leaving. Lasted a year, worked in theatre and education, and just carried on from there, really. So, you know, I've been doing it ever since.
When did Officer Crabtree come into your life?
Well, Officer Crabtree, hello, came into my life in 1985. But look, there was a history, which I wasn't aware of, building up to it, because, I mean, I grew up, another kind of big television favourite of mine was Dad's Army, written by the great David Croft and Jimmy Perry in that way. And also Are You Being Served, which was, again, David Croft, but then with Jeremy Lloyd. I mean, they were things that we watched, you know, everybody watched those. They were funny, and, I mean, Dad's Army is still so. And I thought that the writing for that was, and the comedy and the way the comedy was done was just about as good as it got. So it was a huge influence. And when I went into the profession, it was one of my main ambitions to work with David Croft. I thought, well, that would be something.
Yeah.
And I managed that in either 82 or 83, I can't remember which year, 1982 or 83. I got a small part in Heidi High, and I had a scene with Sue Pollard. And actually, that is how it turned out David Croft used to operate. He would get someone in a small part, and he would really watch them. And if you were good at what you were doing, he'd never forget that. He never forgot anybody. But he also was watching how you worked and got on with other people, whether you were interested in the work and you were taking an interest in other scenes that were being filmed, which I was. I filmed on location at the holiday camp where Heidi High was. And there were four of us that were guest actors in that programme, and we were staying at a different hotel to the main cast. It was like down the road, not quite so expensive. But I remember Sue Pollard saying to me, "Oh, you're coming up to the main hotel tonight, Arthur. You're gonna we'll have a drink and a meal." And so I thought, "Well, yeah, okay, I'll do that." And I asked all the others back at the other hotel, "Are you coming up to see her?" And they were like, "No, I don't think I will. No, I won't." And one of them, much older actress, she said to me, "No, I won't, Arthur, but you must." Which was very interesting because I didn't really realise the significance of what she was saying, but that was an old hand realising how you needed to play the game. But she sort of was at nearer the end of her career and she didn't need to do that. But I was a young actor trying to make my way. So she said, "Oh no, you must go." And I did, and I can remember being very nervous, you know, and in the bar. And then everybody came down, and after a while, David Croft said, "Oh, do come over and join us," you know. And I did that, and blah, 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 blah. Mm. And sat next to Sue in for the meal, and she was outrageous and all of that. Then one of the runners, Robin Carr, who later became a director at the BBC, and even directed Hello, Hello, he kept saying, "You need to come to the episode the rest of the episode has been recorded in the studio. Show up at that." So I did that. And he even got me to show up at the end of the series party, you know, and apparently people would say, "That boy who played that small part, look, he's here at the party at the end of the year." And it was quite nerve-wracking for me to do that because I'm quite shy, actually, as a lot of actors are, actually, and I wasn't great at putting myself forward. So I credit Robin for really helping me. And then eventually the part of Crabtree, which was written for someone else, who at the last minute just before filming dropped out because he got a better offer somewhere else. I won't say who that was, he's sadly no longer with us, but and Robin apparently mentioned my name to David Croft. They saw me plus a lot of other ones and I got the part, and that was that. It's a bit of a, you know, math, but that's how it how, you know, if I'd not turned up to those other things,
you just lodged yourself in someone's mind, and
and it's sort of trying to do that, but that's how it happened.
Like I say, you always have to be ready for opportunity.
And everything so that first series I did, it was written for someone else, but you know, I think, but from then on it was written for me. It was, and I knew as soon as I saw the script, I thought, I have to have this. This is it. I could really see what the potential.
It's a wonderful sitcom. It really is. I mean, for people outside of the UK listening to this, it's World War II, French Resistance. I mean, it's weird because the thing it was sort of pastiching was
actually a previous television series.
Was Secret Army, quite a lot of Doctor Who fans kind of watched, people, because Doctor Who gets people into watching old telly, and so Doctor Who Twitter is quite often full of people embarking on a Secret Army marathon. But it soon became Allo Allo is a thing, and it's almost like most people had forgotten Secret Army.
Yes.
I remember it being on as a kid. We all watched
It was when I was at university, I think, that was on, because my parents were talking about it being on, or sometime after. I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was late 70s.
Yeah, brilliant drama.
Was. But no, I mean, people outside the UK will probably know about Alolo because it's sold to something like 86 countries.
Yeah,
and it's a huge.
Well, I believe your character, obviously, for the benefit of the listeners, obviously you know, is an English undercover. Are you RAF?
No,
it's a spy anyway.
Yeah, it's a spy
undercover as a French gendarme, and the joke is, you don't speak French very well, therefore you don't speak English very well because everyone's speaking accented.
Yeah. Accident. Well, they brought me in. Yeah, the character was sent over from London because I spoke French.
Yeah,
but the joke being, I spoke the sort of dreadful phrase book or O level French that a lot of people, you know, with no attempt.
Yeah.
And I also based it, my idea for it at my interview, which was good, was that it was a bit like Edward Heath, who was a former Prime Minister, who was a great Francophile and he could speak fluent French, but without a trace of a French accent. So it was all sort of, eh bien, nous sommes ici, pour voir, you know, the French. You know, which is so baffled the French, I think. But he knew all the words, just no way. And so I thought, well, I there was never any backstory to Crabtree. We didn't even know what his first name was. I in my backstory, he's called Donald, and he went to a minor public school. A bit of a failure, didn't do very well at exams. Somehow, due to family connections, got into intelligence during the war, you know, but he wasn't intelligent at all, you know. And then probably they sent him over to France to get rid of him, you know, but, you know, we don't know that. Yeah. But I think a lot of people recognise, you know, it's the joke of the British tourist abroad in France trying to make themselves known.
Yeah.
You know, because if you speak English, most people will understand. So it makes us very lazy, you know, about speaking any other language. You know, we expect to be understood everywhere. And so I think it absolutely encapsulated that, so people understood.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many memorable things in LOLO, but I'd say Crabtree is probably most definitely top of the things, because...
Very kind of you.
I mean, well, I mean, in just about everyone I know will every so often there'll be I was just pissing, and you know, there'll be a reason to say something a bit Crabtree, and everyone will know.
And people still do say good morning to each other, as you know, daily greetings.
I mean, yeah,
because I've had it said to me by people who don't know it's me, which is very surreal.
Well, I was going to say with Allo Allo, I mean, I know a lot of actors, and not all of them get to be in the same job for as long as, you know. How long were you in Allo Allo?
Was it beginning to end? You know, my sort of final time with it really was, because we had the stage version of it, which went all over the place. So that continued even beyond when we finished the TV series. So I was with the TV series from 1985, which was the second series. And to the final series, which went out in 1993. So that's 8 years. But then beyond that, we were still doing the stage version. So 10 years, really, from 85 to 95.
Yeah, I mean, that...
And it was pretty full on for most of that time as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's where, because we're here talking about Doctor Who, that sort of being associated with a character... And having the stability and the work environment of being with the same cast, I mean, in a way, it must have been joyful, hard work, but
yeah. It you see, when you're making a TV show, I mean, we did know when we were first doing it, there were only four channels on TV in this country, and we were getting 15 million a week on a Monday evening. And when we came in the ratings after, because that was just before EastEnders started then. So we were getting, so we were after, say, Coronation Street, you know, and then there was us. Well, I mean, you see quoted figures now with all the different channels, you know, big things that, you know, something like Happy Valley, I think, that's on at the moment, you know. That got 8.3 million, you know.
It's huge.
Well, that's huge now, not then. That would have been considered a relative failure.
Yeah.
You know, but 15 million, which was one in four people in the country, was watching.
Well, I think Doctor Who's record was 20 million because ITV were on strike.
Oh, wow.
And it was a particularly good episode. But I think that was their sort of peak under Tom Baker, the City of Death, sort of famously... Hits the heights, but you know, that many people.
Yeah, I mean,
watching the same TV.
But when you're making it, and we did make it with a studio audience too, people think it's canned laughter, and it's not. You can always tell that it's canned laughter because we would leave a pause, we would stop while people are laughing and come in at the end of it. So you can always tell whether it's real or not. You know, no actor would talk over a big laugh.
You
can't be heard. You know.
Yeah.
So. We always did it to about 350 in the audience, you know, in the studio. So that was our audience. We were playing it to them, but you never thought, because you can't think of 15 million or something like that. I mean, when I got used to it a bit, if you ever get used to being recognised or stuff, which you don't really, because it's weird. But you know, I'd be on a train or something. I'd be going past, and you'd have you just notice a house with a TV aerial. like this millions of them. But I think, I wonder if those people in that house there know who I am. What's me, you know? And it, I mean, it's weird, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it totally changes your life.
Yeah. No, I imagine.
In good ways and in bad ways.
Well, I was going to say, did you get the sort of Victor Meldrew of, you know, I can't believe it shouted at you? Did you get recognised and people?
Yeah, yeah.
People just don't have the barrier, don't have the personal space. No, and just I mean, shout good morning
used
at
to,
you.
It used to upset me a bit when, you know, somebody. You can always tell when someone's noticed you, but then you go past them, then they would say the word to your retreating back, which I always thought was rude. But if somebody, you know, if people stop you on the street very politely and say, I just wanted to say, you know, thanks so much for giving us all those laughs over the years. But I've had that a lot, you know.
Mm.
And I think, well, that's absolutely lovely, you know. And it makes you, it sort of brings you out and think, well, yeah, I am in the entertainment business. And there's time, like in the pandemic, for instance, quite a lot of people got in touch, said, we've been watching the box set up for Low Hello again. Thanks for all the loves. It's helped us get through the pandemic. You know, pandemic, you think, well, that's not bad. I'll take that. You know, it's lovely. It's not that I need that praise, but if people come and say that, that's delightful. But there is the other side where it can almost be used as a weapon.
Yeah. Know? Well, I think Doctor Who actors with the certain fans probably can most identify with being hassled by the general public.
Yeah.
And but also in the sense that that cast of people, you're forever sort of in that club with, they're the only ones that will know what it was like. Like, not a lot of actors get the blues on closing night, and you got to have 10 years working with a lot of the same people. And
yeah, and we, and some of the, I mean, we were the young ones then, you know, there were lots of much older, all of whom have gone, you know, years ago. The older ones.
Well, even Gordon Kay went far too quite a few. Soon, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He was only sort of early 70s.
Yeah.
And, but the others, it's strange. So we were the young ones, and now we're quite old ourselves, you know. But, you know, there still is that camaraderie. It's just shared experience.
Yeah. Do they have LOLO conventions and things like that?
We often appear on fan conventions of other things. In fact, I can give you a kind of cross reference thing, actually, from LOLO to Doctor Who. It's something that still makes me laugh. We were at, I think it was Memorabilia at the NEC years ago, and it was the last time, I mean, there were 11 of us, including Gordon Kay, was there at that event, and we were sitting there, and there were a lot of Doctor Who people there.
Mm-hmm.
I think Colin Baker was there, but other ones were there. But there were, it was when these new amazing, totally realistic Daleks kits, you know, were going, which, you know, I finally saw them, and they were buzzing around the NEC, and I just thought, God, you know, took myself back to, if I would have killed for one of it, you know, because there were a couple of competitions where they were sold off. I think they, particularly from the film version.
I think there were a couple of grand to buy your own Dalek now.
Yeah, but this one, so they were, and it's even got a thing inside that converts your voice into a Dalek voice, you know. And I just thought it was great. But what happened is we were all sitting behind our trestle tables with our photos and all that stuff, and there wasn't much activity at that moment. And suddenly this Dalek came round the corner and came towards us, and he went straight towards Sue Hodge, who played Mimi in it. And she looked up from her table and she said to the Dalek, "Hello, how are you?" And this Dalek voice went, "I am very well, thank you." And I thought, no, Daleks don't say that. They just tell you what to do or kill you.
They are brilliant.
But I thought, there's some kid in there that's just so thrilled. And, so that was when the one and only moment when Doctor Who met
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you! On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic new saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega El Tralla, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
Well, I was going to say, because, I mean, you mentioned Karen Silvera was in Celestial Toymaker, but Gruber
was it?
Guy Siner was. He was in Genesis of the Daleks.
Yes, and I think he may have been Thal as well. That way.
Oh, yeah.
He may well have.
Yeah, but he was General Ravon.
Yeah.
When I'm doing this podcast, Genesis of the Daleks comes up time and time again as one of the five. Because I mean, you were saying before we started recording that you fell in love with Doctor Who when you were a child, and then you sort of watched it. What was your experience with it into the 70s?
Well, particularly, I loved Patrick Troughton.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had to put a vote in, he was my favourite. But Tom Baker was brilliant, and he was my doctor when I was at university. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I mean, people didn't have their own TV in a room or anything like that. Mm. There was a TV in the junior common room. Durham's a collegiate university, like Oxford and Cambridge. Well, my college was the smallest college, and we had a big TV, colour TV, in the junior common room, which I only ever watched on a Saturday tea time, as did about another 100 students. And we used to, tea was served just about 10 minutes before Doctor Who started. And so everybody would get in there, grab we were allowed to do this, put a plate full of food in, rush into the common room to get a decent seat on a chair somewhere, or on the floor, cross-legged, to watch it.
Yeah.
And
I love that. I love that idea of Doctor Who being...
And that was the only telly I watched in 3 years of being at university. And every Saturday was this thing. And I do clearly remember once another student from the college walking in to the common room at that point and saying really loudly, "Has anybody seen..." And about to mention someone's name. And about 100 men just turned away. "Oh, shut up," or whatever like that.
He was
silenced and left. You know. But he was amazed because obviously he wasn't part of that thing. But that, I think that in itself just says how huge it was even then. So that would have been about 1974, 75, 76 time, you know, sometime between then that occurred.
Yeah, but that was the golden... For many people will disagree, but everyone has their own favourite, but that's the golden era.
No, he was brilliant.
Tom Baker was just born to be, as he says himself, he's, you know, I think he said it's something along the lines of, he's, you know, "I'm an okay actor, but there's only one that I'm very good at being the Doctor."
No, he was. What he was. He made it his own totally. And actually, I mean, I was dead chuffed. About 6 years ago, I did a radio play by Toby Haydo.
Oh, yeah, of course, yes.
Now, it had more than a little, you know, affinity with certain aspects of... It was a super little play. And I played this weird character.
For the listeners, Toby Haydoke is a super fan, which most of you will know, but some of our, maybe some of our American listeners won't know. But I know Toby because he's obviously in Manchester well, which he used to live in.
Well, I played this thing, and it was called... I can't remember the title of it. It was a sort of send-up of...
But it wasn't a Doctor Who.
No, it wasn't, but it was very Doctor Who-ish. Yes. And my character was kind of weird like that. He told me after it had gone out, he'd had an email from Tom Baker saying, I really enjoyed it, particularly liked what Arthur Bostrom was doing. And I just thought, wow, that really, coming from him, you know, because I so admired what he did and how he made it his own.
I haven't met Tom Baker. He is kind of like my childhood hero.
Yeah, I know, I totally get it. And I think, you know, so many different people for whatever time you locked in. I mean, it's difficult for me to judge. I mean, I could say, you know, I got so much from William Hartnell, Patrick Troughton, and Tom Baker. And that's not taking anything away from John Pertwee either. It was, he was great, but I went off the series a bit because it was so, it was based in Earth. And we never saw the TARDIS for years. You know?
Yeah, no, it's a strange era. I love that era, but it was before my time, so obviously I had to discover it as an adult.
And yeah, I kind of went off it, and then subsequently, because I can't remember, was it Tom Baker after him or
after John Pertwee? Yes.
Yeah, so that's where I got back on board again. It's like, well, here we go again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As I said, that has nothing to do with John Pertwee as an actor. No, I think he's a wonderful actor. And he too was a brilliant doctor.
Yeah.
It was just, I went off the programme a bit.
Well, it intersects with our real life, doesn't it? I mean, I know someone who's one of the, you know, he's one of the biggest Doctor Who fans. I mean, Gary Russell, he said this, you know, he doesn't, you know, you might have worked for him when you did Big Finish, but he was one of the founders of Big Finish. And he always says, he switched off when it was Tom Baker, biggest fan ever, but didn't like what Doctor Who became during Tom Baker, particularly it wasn't for him, and as soon as it was Peter Davison again, he was back in. So, you know, everyone's slightly different.
I can't understand
how you would not watch
I was the opposite of that. I kind of fell off with Peter Davison, and I think Peter Davison is a wonderful actor.
Yeah.
I always did. And he's had that chameleon-like ability to be totally different, but it was, I think, what he was given to do when the costume it became very costume, sort of yellow coat or something.
It was a word, but it was for some reason he was dressed in cricketing.
Oh, that's it.
Really,
it was the trappings of it that kind of, and that carried on more. You know, I mean, the original Doctor Who, you know, he had a very old-fashioned sort of garb or whatever like that. And, yeah, Tom Baker had the famous scarf and all of that,
yeah.
The mad hair and all of that, and the long coat. Mm. That's all good. But it started to become, it's like K-9, I can't remember when K-9 came in, but I wasn't wild about K-9.
No, 70.
Okay. You know, gimmicky.
But yeah, and, 78, and so, 77, 78.
Oh, right. Well, yes, it was, because so therefore, it lost that kind of... it became more about things and visual than the mystery of not quite knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
It was more about explanation and knowing stuff and sort of a bit more gimmicky.
Yeah. Yeah,
but then so many series do that. I mean, Star Trek to a certain extent has done it. You know, it's gone off in different directions, whatever like that. But although I think that still remained close to its core values, right? Doctor Who now for me is almost unrecognisable from what I started with. But then that's bound to happen.
Yeah,
you couldn't have shaky sets and stuff. Which, if you look at it, there's bits been chopped out of it where it's been roughly brought out from the prop store. You know?
Oh, God,
you know, I never noticed any of that. But then, you know, we had a very creaky black and white set with a small thing on it, so none of that was noticed.
Like, now you can see where someone's peeled some gaffer tape off the top of that's obviously been stuck on a Dalek's dome. And yeah,
well, I was
you can see the imprint.
I was fascinated, you know, as I've said before, by the TARDIS itself, and it's with the circles on the wall,
yeah,
you know, stuff like that. Well, I mean, I've looked at old stuff like that, and I think they were done by very thin, almost like plastic plates put on the wall like that. And some of them have been clearly a bit bashed in, and nobody's thought to, you know, get them out. And like, I looked at something, I thought, that's not what I remember from that time. And I think some of them are even on casters, you know, so they're brought in.
Oh, yeah, they're flats, and they're just like, brought
so
in.
So when the camera goes a little bit low, you'll notice that.
Yeah.
I mean, the mythology of it all, another mix, you know, of Hello, Hello and Doctor Who, just off the top of my head, was when we took the stage show out and we took it abroad to New Zealand and Australia. And we were out at one point in Perth, Western Australia, for 6 weeks doing the stage show. And the Hello, Hello stage show always had like supporting artists, like you would have on like we had on the television, because you needed more people to sit at the tables in the Cafe Rene scenes and all that. They were also understudying parts, but they came on stage. And there was one, this lovely guy, short, so quite elderly, and called Kevin Mansa, who one day talking to him, he turned out was one of the original Dalek operators.
Oh, wow.
And you'll see him, his name, and I thought, well, he was really quite short, but yeah, you'd fit in them. And he said, it's the reason really I got the job, he said, you know. But just lovely, because again, it was like, yeah, it just immediately from that point, you know, I was in then my mid-30s or something, but it just took me back to an eight-year-old and that fantasy of owning a Dalek or being in it or whatever, and what if, you know, I wanted it so much. And here, so to me, you know, Kevin, who was, you know, I was one of the stars of the show, but here is the star that's involved in our show, and it's like, wow, you know, well,
that magic of Doctor Who that runs for 60 years, like, you know, Tom Baker talked about how many times he's been in an audition and he realised someone who watched him as a kid has now grown up and they've got a job in telly and that's the only reason he's been auditioned. And similarly with, you know, further down, like Sylvester McCoy ends up in the Hobbit movies because Peter Jackson's a massive Doctor Who fan.
Oh, I wondered about that's interesting. And he was brilliant in that movie.
Absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant. I think he was the best thing in it, to be honest.
Yeah. I wasn't too enamored. I love the Lord of the Rings film.
Yeah, I wasn't too enamored, but you know, anybody that said no, I didn't think much to it, but I thought he stole the show.
He's fantastic. And but I've done a similar thing. I've got, you know, I've got an audio drama horror, nothing to do with Doctor Who, but I've sort of like, well, let's see who we can cast, and I ended up, you know, so I'm just busy. We're just busy in the edit, so it's going to come out soon. Sort of a 4-disc horror, Liverpool connection, because it's Ramsey Campbell. The horror writer who lives here. But yeah, so I've got Louise Jameson, I've got Colin Baker, Peter Davison.
Brilliant.
And and I was like, well, I'm almost thinking, oh God, another Doctor Who actor said yes, and I'm not complaining, but have we got too many Doctor Who people? And I was like, oh, do you know what?
All so good.
But they're all brilliant, and they also love doing something that isn't Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But I've got Peter Davison and Colin Baker acting in scenes together, which actually will mean is it actually doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't.
And they're all brilliant. They're all mates from the convention circuit.
Yeah.
And
they're all respectful of each other.
Yeah. And the lovely Mina Anwar is in. I don't know if you know Mina, because she's Manchester based. Mina obviously from the Sarah Jane Adventures gets to be part of the.
She's fabulous.
Oh, I love Mina. Yeah, she's brilliant.
She and I appeared together on Pointless Celebrity
as
a team. And because the theme was all the powers were something to do with the police. Well, she was in
Thin Blue Line.
So we made for an interesting pair. But I knew her from Manchester anyway. I'd met her before. So
she's
fantastic.
She's so supportive and such a force of nature.
Oh, she is a force of nature. She's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal actor.
Absolutely brilliant.
She really is.
Yeah. No, I hope I get to work with her more.
So
we sort of touched upon Dalek Invasion of Earth as one of your choices, the sort of ruined London. Do you remember, just briefly, Do you remember watching that live?
I do remember watching it live, and I can remember being
such a great idea, isn't it?
Yeah, it's such a great idea, because there was this thing of they land in London, and I remember Barbara and Ian. Oh wow, we're home, and yet there was something wrong. You know, there was nobody about.
Mm.
It was when you occasionally you'd see someone, but they're running or they're trying to hide or something. And the whole episode, you know, and it had been really.
It starts with a suicide. It's very, very disturbing. Oh, very dark and disturbing. A man running through the ruins, ruins of a man running through the ruins of a city, as Terence Dicks put it in the novel, or something like that.
Oh, right. I've forgotten that.
But
it had been so hyped that it's the return of the Daleks that, you know, everybody, we're all sat in the room. And it doesn't appear until the last frame.
Yeah.
Which is now regarded, but it is brilliant because you suddenly, you're looking out on the Thames and then you see a head appear and it comes out of the water, which is, you know, it trundles out and then it's the theme music and you've got to wait till next week to carry on. But it was, oh wow, we had, that's all we get. But then you look back and you think, yeah, but what was to come? I mean, they were... How did they manage to get out of, you know, because in the first series of it, they're on a kind of magnetic floor, you know, static electricity or something, that they're fired by, well, how come they're going around the streets? And they've got these little kind of dishes on their back. And there's a spaceship that they've got and all of that. But it was seeing them in, you know, like there's an iconic little bit where one of them going over one of the bridges over the Thames, and you just it's shot from the riverbank, and you just see the top part there moving, and it just like.
But is it Westminster Bridge, because the Houses of Parliament and Big Ben are in the background, aren't they? Yeah, it is. It's absolutely iconic.
It is, photograph. And it really captured our imagination, that the idea that they could be in London and the real fear of it, and. They were ruthless. I mean, utterly ruthless.
Yeah, there's something Day of the Triffids-y about it. Yeah, that sort of.
Yeah.
That sort of. It's they're in the everyday, like society has fallen apart and monsters roam the streets.
It was there were two things going on as well with it, because the subplot was granddaughter Susan, Caroline Ford, heaven knows what age she actually was, because she was still playing a sort of 18-year-old.
Yeah.
She was, I think, into her 30s by then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so... But it was you sort of sensed she was on her way out.
Yeah.
And it was really well done, actually, I think.
Yeah, she actually... At least they gave her a love story.
She gave her a love story, and she wanted to stay behind, and, you know, and Hartnell's doctor was really quite angry about it. It was Barbara and Ian, I think, that, you know, come on, let her.
Yeah.
You know.
But then he locks her out of the TARDIS. Because she changes her mind and then he locks her out of the TARDIS.
I forgot that, you see.
Yeah. So everyone says, and that's the thing everyone keeps. Some fans are desperate for Susan to sort of, you know, surely. There's lots of audios involving Caroline Ford reprising the character.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's one of the sort of unfinished. Stories from Doctor Who is he has a granddaughter, but they've made no mention of wives or sex or how Time Lords really reproduce. It's sort of, you know, skirted over, but he has someone he called a granddaughter right at the beginning.
Yeah,
but it's an interesting. I think it's probably best just left in the mystery of the past rather than trying to having to explain everything.
Well, exactly, and I think you did accept. I mean, as I was very young, so I did accept what happened. I'd had forgotten that, and it's come back to me now. It's very moving.
Letting her go so she can grow up, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then you're there going, but now it's like, well, now we know you're Time Lords, and that's where it made sense at the time. And when you look back, everything's been built on since. It's like, why did he leave your daughter on post-apocalyptic 22nd century?
You've got that with all the sort of Thor business with Marvel now, because, you know, these supposedly eternal beings, but they've got a father and a mother.
So,
you know, how does that work? And when do they go? Or, you know, all that's a bit, it's like, don't go there, you know.
And, yeah.
I mean, you know, I think all series have that. Whether the, you know, trying to get an internal logic again with a lower low. You see, every now and then, it used to come up within our program. Somebody would say,
"What year is it?"
Well, not just that
in
but,
your program,
no, but all about like if you were speaking in a French accent, you were French. If you were speaking in a German accent, you were German. The French and German strangely understood each other, but the British airmen, they didn't understand that. So that, and somebody said, well, how does that sort of, how, and David Croft used to say, no, it's a can of worms, don't go there, it's, everything's working fine, it's very successful and very funny, let's not bother with that, you know, and so that was, that would shut that down. And it must be, that must have happened time and again, no pun intended, with Doctor Who, you know.
Oh yeah, but then some fans want everything like explained. I'm like, I think maybe you need to become a Star Trek fans. Where they explain everything.
Lower low fans will do this at a concert. Someone will come up and say, in episode 46, you walk into the cafe and you say something or another, and I go, really? Did I? You know, it's like, because I did sort of 78 episodes. I mean, 30 something, 35 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I do remember iconic moments. Like, I was missing by, you know, blah, blah, and other certain bits. But there's whole loads of it. I can see a repeat now. And I'll watch myself walk in, and I've no idea what I'm about to say, and I don't remember the scene, you know, because we just did it, so many of them.
And
fans sometimes find that hard to believe.
Just back to Doctor Who. Before we get to your final choice, which is the War Games, one reason we're here is because of what you're doing with Warp Vorp, the audio of the sort of Varna animation script, which for those who don't know, was a Canadian company in the 90s when Doctor Who looked like it was never going to come back. They were going to sort of do an animated version, which would have been a crazy thing if that had actually got off the ground, but then it sort of fell apart.
I never knew anything about
it's kind of news to me, but it's fascinating. What I've seen of the article, I've seen the PDFs of the magazine that's about to go to print, that it's all in, which will also include, like, as we were saying before we started talking, that, like, Colin Brockhurst, the designer, just the wonderful work he's done. But I mean, that poster of you as the Doctor, because you're playing the Doctor in this audio version. What's it like playing the Doctor in such a weird...
Well, I've got to say, it really was. And this is such a cliche, but it was a dream come true, because, and it, you know, what we've been talking about it took me right back to my 8-year-old self playing in the garden shed pretending I was the Doctor. You know, it was a dream of all of us that were fans of it to either be in it, even though no intention of becoming a professional, it seemed completely something that we couldn't do. But when I did become a professional actor, I mean, I did think, or maybe now possibly I could be in it. And I mentioned this on the booklet, but a friend of mine who was at drama school with me was in an episode called Earthshock.
Oh yeah.
Which is a Cyberman adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was actually killed by a Cyberman, and I was hugely jealous of that. I mean, and
that's in many people's top five.
Yeah, yeah, episodes. I know. So, at the time, we didn't know. It's just a mate of my God, someone I know is in Doctor Who, and I was really kind of envious of it. And then I can remember thinking, oh, maybe I'll get in it, and maybe I'll be exterminated by Dalek, you know. And I did cling to it, and I did do, you know, a Doctor Who on Big Finish years ago. But I wasn't playing the Doctor, obviously. But
that was with Paul McGann. Paul McGann, you know, Fisher. So that was the early days of early-ish days of Big Finish.
Yes.
Beginning of the century.
Yeah, it was about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Or possibly slightly more.
And
so I did. So I did appear, you know, or I was heard in a Doctor Who episode. In terms of that, that's the closest I got. And then for this, you know, which also came from the suggestion from people I knew anyway, and I knew that they were what I refer to as Doctor Who heads, you know, I mean, and they thought of me. And also the reasoning that, that was given to me, well, I said, well, I'd love to, you know, whatever, you know, what fun, I said, I'd love to do that. And when I read the script, you know, Sean Mason, who I know is has done an audio, has adapted that script, you know, for this. And it's a lovely piece, and it's and it work, really works as an episode. And the way the Doctor Who lines come, I thought, well, there is a character here that I've got to find, and I, you know, it's up to the listeners whether I did, but I felt it was very much my sort of thing, my kind of where it was written, you know, it's witty, so it's got this sort of wit to it, and even there's even because it does contain Daleks, you see, it is a Dalek adventure, so, and I even have a bit of, you know, in the way that it's in the classic tradition of the hero who's just about to be killed, but before they're killed, has a conversation with the person who's going to kill them. You know, like every Bond film ever had that, or anything like that. Well, this is what it's like. So you've got the Supreme Dalek kind of playing with me, and then it never happens, you know. So, but, and I thought, well, that's not bad. I'll take that. I've done this. So, and then these mock-ups that Colin Brockhurst has done of pictures of me in this, and I'm just astounded what he's done with it. Because it's a plausible, I could actually see myself as that.
I think so, you'd be a great doctor.
Well, the idea they thought, well, you know, at the time when it was coming,
Shooty Get was
when it had finished, it was early 90s, and they said, well, you were then playing an iconic television character yourself at that time, so, you know, if the choice of who the next one would be, you would have been, I'm sure you would have been in the mix, which is something I've never thought of. And so I thought, well, maybe. So they said, so we think it's perfect for someone who was a sort of 80s and 90s icon. And I just thought, wow, you know. So the whole thing was just, it's been delightful.
A little peek into the parallel universe.
Yeah, very much so. And I thought, you know, I still haven't been in an episode of Doctor Who, but to my amazement, the thing goes on. So I still hold on, you know, maybe one day.
Well, yeah. Well, but definitely, definitely. If I ever get the keys to the TARDIS, I'll call you up.
Very good. Yeah, take me to the time when it can happen. Take me to that parallel universe.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. So your final choice is a sort of goodbye to your favourite Doctor, Patrick Troughton. Yeah. In the War Games.
Yeah.
I mean, you 69, so were you, how does this fit
14,
in with your,
yeah,
so
14.
How does it fit into that time of life?
Still, 14, still a big, still a big fan, but it's a very sophisticated story.
Yeah.
And it's the last, it is the last one with Patrick Troughton, but also the last with both Wendy Padbury as Zoe and Fraser Hines as Jamie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all kind of exit as a result of it. And it was also a very long series. There's 10 episodes, so it was going on week by week. And because I was always fascinated by anything that focused on the TARDIS itself, it had, you know, what happens in it is they land, whether it's a planet that's being used, but I can't remember, but it's got different time zones in it, and, you know, and there's a war going on, but if you go through a sort of fog bank, you find yourself in another time zone, and then there's Roman legions, and then in another one there's something else, you know, and really interesting. And it turns out that there are these sort of everyday TARDISes going from zone to zone, and they've got the kind of similar sound of Doctor Who's TARDIS, but without that kind of grating sound in the background. They've got the sound of the classic sound of these things moving around. And there's a whole bank of them.
I know, it's fascinating.
And the, you know, and they just one goes and it disappears within that, and then it appears in the next, you know. The whole setup was, because it was so really time-based, so it had that mystery of things that we can't explain. Mm. How is this put together? What's going on here? And it's quite some time, before, you know, 10 episodes, it's quite some time before that's actually identified and what this thing is really all about. So it's very mysterious. The acting's very good. I always liked Fraser Hines, but he's really up for it, you know. He's a bit over Scottish, of course. You know, maybe the Scots were too, but it's such a strong, lively character he played.
Yeah.
And a lovely foil with Wendy Padbury, who's from the future.
Yeah.
You know, already.
Oh, it's
with a scientific brain, who was much more up with what was going, could even offer suggestions to the doctor about what might be going on.
I mean, she's after my time, but when I started watching stuff that was from that era, such a crush on Wendy Padbury.
Really?
I mean, I guess the cat suit and the
Well, she was
and the 60s bob and
all of that. No, she was great. Yeah. She was great, and no, I liked it. And then with this extraordinary. Thing at the end, when the only way he can get them back to where they were supposed to be is to, you know, is to bring in the Time Lords,
yeah,
which we've never heard of before, and that's finally,
yeah,
well, I think we've never heard of them.
No,
before.
No, that's the first time they mentioned,
and that's where we they've find just, out who just he is and where he come from. I don't think Gallifrey is.
No, that's not till later, but yeah, they.
So it's still mysterious.
Yeah,
so it was fascinating, but also. In retrospect, disappointing because that mystery was solved.
Yeah.
But I loved the way in which, you know, before he was being kind of made to go back to Earth, for which he had apparently had enough affinity with, so we're going to send you back there for a while and you will lose the ability to use your TARDIS, so you'll be Earth-based. But before they do that, they manage to take Jamie and Zoe back to their times, but just like 2 seconds before they were originally taken.
Yeah, so they have them.
So they kind of sort of, what was that? And then they you know, they get on with their lives, which was kind of very moving, really.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. I mean, it's sort of, I think people forget that it's not just the modern series that, you know, had proper grown-up storytelling a lot. You know, the old series did have...
With the mystery and with low budgets, or just not the kind of ability to create things that you could now. I mean, I've got last summer and this year as well, I've been doing a one-man show. This is relevant because of the line it had in it. Called Are You Being Murdered, where I play a supporting artist on Are You Being Served, and somebody is killed and I become, you know, the sleuth and find out who it is. So of course, Are You Being Murdered, which I think is one of the great titles of all time. There's a line in it near the beginning where I'm describing my job as a supporting artist. We get to work, and the writer, who's brilliant, who writes for Father Brown's, David Semple, and he also writes for Doctors, the series, and many other things. But he said, I get to work. We get to work in all sorts of exotic locations. Or if it's Doctor Who, a sand pit.
Yeah.
And I just clicked with that line because there's so many times where they did an external thing. And I thought, well, I'm a Doctor Who head from way back. Will the audience get it? But it was amazing to me how many times the audience were absolutely on that. It got quite a big laugh.
Yeah,
they recognised it.
Oh, it's part of. It's not just Doctor. It's not just the fans that watched.
Because often the TARDIS itself would land in that, and it was supposed to be a desert,
some quarry
planet, or it's some quarry that they kept going back to.
Yeah. Oh, we're in the quarry again.
I know. I love that.
it's such a.
So it goes on. That just goes to show how it's in. It's in everybody's DNA almost.
Oh yeah. It's such a wonderful show, and not, you know. I can't imagine my life without it.
No, I can't.
Because it just something clicked when I was young.
Yeah.
And as it did with you and millions of people.
Yeah.
And just wonderful. But anyway, Arthur Bostrom, it's been wonderful to chat to you about your life through the prism of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And look forward to seeing you in the real world in the future.
Thanks, I've really enjoyed it.
The whole
experience.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for the coffee. We'll probably fade out on this one.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe. Thank you.